You're listening to The Philosopher's Note on the Nicomachean Ethics. More wisdom in less time.
Hi, this is Brian. Welcome to The Philosopher's Note on the Nicomachean Ethics by Aristotle. As always, we're going to kick it off with a quote, but this one is from the contemporary philosopher Jonathan Barnes, who wrote the introduction to this great Penguin classic, and then we'll jump into some wisdom from Aristotle. Barnes tells us, quote, "Internally too, the ethics has a structure. It may be summarized thus. Our task is to become good men, or to achieve the highest human good. That good is happiness. And happiness is an activity of the soul in accordance with virtue." That's book one. "Virtue is therefore to be analyzed and the conditions for virtuous action determined," books two through three. "And the various virtues, moral and intellectual, must be described," that's books four through six, and books eight through nine. "Pleasure, intimately tied to virtue by more than one cord, must also be anatomized." That's books 7 and 10. "And finally, the nature of happiness and the means of ensuring it can be laid down," book 10. The key concepts here, which are not perfectly represented by the English words virtue and happiness, will call for elucidation later on, but their structural interrelations are immediately discernible, and it is these which provide the internal frame of the ethics, end quote. Again, that is from the introduction by Jonathan Barnes II, The Nicomachean Ethics by Aristotle. Aristotle was born in Macedonia in 384 BC. At the age of 17, he went to Athens, where he studied with Plato at his academy for 20 years, until Plato passed away. Shortly thereafter, he was summoned back to Macedonia to tutor the 13-year-old Alexander the Great. From there, he returned to Athens, where he established the Lyceum, and, quote, "explored and expounded and taught the entire field of human knowledge, logic, metaphysics, theology, history, politics, ethics, aesthetics, psychology, anatomy, biology, zoology, botany, astronomy, meteorology, and the ancient equivalents of physics and chemistry." His writings have been extraordinarily influential since ancient times, while the Lyceum, again a quote from the introduction, lived on for some 500 years after its founder's death. As a stimulus, a challenge, an inspiration, and a formative influence on subsequent thought, Jonathan Barnes tells us, it was scarcely matched and never surpassed. Here's a recap of the most epic lineage ever. Socrates taught Plato, Plato taught Aristotle. They all taught us a lot. Now, this book is named after Aristotle's son, who essentially edited his lecture notes. It's fascinating to imagine Aristotle using these notes to teach 2,300 years ago. As per the intro above, the Ethics has 10 books. The first four are the most practical and where we will be spending all of our time. You know all those Aristotle quotes on happiness and habits and the doctrine of the mean? You'll find most of them in this classic. As you can imagine, the book is packed with big ideas. We're obviously only going to scratch the surface of this masterpiece, but I'm excited to share some of my favorites we can apply to our lives today, so let's jump straight in. First big idea, the ultimate end, eudaimonic happiness. Quote, "The end is no doubt happiness, but views of happiness differ." Aristotle tells us, "Since all knowledge and every pursuit aim at some good, what do we take to be the end of political science? What is the highest of all practical goods?" Well, so far as the name goes, there is pretty much agreement. It is happiness, say both ordinary and cultured people, and they identify happiness with living well or doing well. But when it comes to saying in what happiness consists, opinions differ, and the account given by the generality of mankind is not at all like that of the wise. The former take it to be something obvious and familiar, like pleasure or money or eminence, and there are various other views. And often the same person actually changes his opinion. When he falls ill, he says that it is health, and when he is hard up, that it is money. Conscious of their own ignorance, most people are impressed by anyone who pontificates and says something that is over their heads. Some, however, have held the view that over and above these particular goods, there is another, which is good in itself and the cause of whatever goodness there is in all these others. It would no doubt be rather futile to examine all these opinions, enough if we consider those which are the most prevalent or seem to have something to be said for them. End quote. Happiness, that's the ultimate aim, the supreme good that we're all after. In Happier, Tal Ben-Shahar calls this the ultimate currency. But I wish we could interview Aristotle for the Optimized podcast so we can ask him to explain what the Greek word we weakly translate as happiness actually means. The word Aristotle uses to capture the ultimate aim of life is not happiness as we use the word. It was the Greek word eudaimonia. Jonathan Barnes, the author of the introduction to this Penguin classic, makes the very strong point that, quote, to call a man eudaimon is to say something about how he lives and what he does. The notion of eudaimonia is closely tied, in a way in which the notion of happiness is not, to success. The eudaimon is someone who makes a success of his life and actions, who realizes his aims and ambitions as a man, who fulfills himself, end quote. In other words, the ultimate aim of life is not happiness as we know it, but more of a sense of actualization. Which, by the way, is one of the reasons why Martin Seligman evolved his philosophical framework and book titles from Authentic Happiness to Flourish. True happiness, in the Aristotelian sense, must include the successful actualization of our potentialities. That is the ultimate purpose of life, the highest good, the summum bonum. Which leads us back to Barnes and another one of his brilliant points. He says, quote, it will not do to replace happiness by success or fulfillment as a translation of eudaimonia. The matter is too complicated for any such simple remedy. And in what follows, I shall continue to employ the word happiness, guarding it with a pair of inverted commas. But it is worth considering Aristotle's recipe for eudaimonia with the notion of success in mind. The ethics, we are thus supposing, is not telling us how to be morally good men, or even how to be humanly happy. It is telling us how to live successful human lives, how to fulfill ourselves as men. End quote. And woman, of course, and all of that hints at why virtue is so important, which leads us to our next idea on how we go about achieving eudaimonia. The next big idea, the path to eudaimonia, arete. Quote, but what is happiness? If we consider what the function of man is, we find that happiness is a virtuous activity of the soul. But presumably to say that happiness is a supreme good seems a platitude, and some more distinctive account of it is still required. This might perhaps be achieved by grasping what is the function of man. If we take a flutist or a sculptor or any artist, or in general any class of men who have a specific function or activity, his goodness and proficiency are considered to lie in the performance of that function. But is it likely that whereas joiners and shoemakers have certain functions or activities, man as such has none, but has been left by nature a functionless being? Just as we can see that eye and hand and foot and every one of our members have some function, should we not assume that in like manner a human being has a function over and above these particular functions? What then can this possibly be? Clearly, life is a thing shared also by plants, and we are looking for man's proper function. So we must exclude from our definition the life that consists in nutrition and growth. Next in order would be a sort of sentient life. But this too we see is shared by horses and cattle and animals of all kinds. There remains then a practical life of the rational part. This has two aspects, one amenable to reason, the other possessing it and initiating thought. As this life also has two meanings, we must lay down that we intend here life determined by activity, because this is accepted as the stricter sense. Now, if the function of man is an activity of the soul in accordance with or implying a rational principle, and if we hold that the function of an individual and of a good individual of the same kind, e.g. of a harpist and a good harpist and so on generally, is generically the same, the latter's distinctive excellence being attached to the name of the function, because the function of the harpist is to play the harp, but that of a good harpist is to play it well. And if we assume that the function of man is a kind of life, namely, an activity or a series of actions of the soul, implying a rational principle, and if the function of a good man is to perform these well and rightly, and if every function is performed well when performed in accordance with its proper excellence, if all this is so, the conclusion is that the good for man is an activity of the soul in accordance with virtue. Or, if there are more kinds of virtue than one, in accordance with the best and most perfect kind. End quote. Now, that might be the longest passage we've shared as a big idea. I'm sharing it to A, show the logical coherence of Aristotle's thinking, and B, let him articulate his logical framework for why happiness is a virtuous activity of the soul. Now, as per our last idea, the ultimate aim in life, why we do any and everything, is to achieve happiness. But not happiness as we tend to think about it, happiness in the deepest sense of flourishing and succeeding in actualizing our potential. We know that eudaimonia means more than just happiness. Break it down, and you'll see that it literally means good, or you, plus soul, daimon, eudaimon. Or, as Aristotle states it here, happiness is a virtuous activity of the soul. In short, you want eudaimonic happiness? Live with virtue. Which leads us to my favorite word, arete. As we've discussed, although the word arete directly translates as virtue or excellence, it has a deeper meaning, something closer to expressing the best version of yourself. When? Right now, and now, and now, and now. For how long? Well, that leads us to the paragraph that immediately follows the one referenced above. Aristotle says, there is a further qualification for attaining eudaimonic happiness in a complete lifetime. He says, one swallow does not make a summer, neither does one day. Similarly, neither can one day or a brief space of time make a man blessed and happy. End quote. Translation, eudaimonic happiness doesn't happen in a day or a week or a month. We're never exonerated. It takes a lifetime of excellence to actualize. Little PS here, you know that Aristotle quote, we are what we repeatedly do, excellence then is not an act, but a habit? Well, he didn't actually say that. He said what I just quoted above about the swallows. It was Will Durant who paraphrased that wisdom so poetically. I've got a little link in the note so you can check out some more details on that sleuthing. We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. It is true. Thank you, Will Durant, for paraphrasing Aristotle so beautifully. Next big idea, how to win at the Olympic Games. Quote, now our definition is in harmony with those who say that happiness is virtue, or a particular virtue, because an activity in accordance with virtue implies virtue. But presumably, it makes no little difference whether we think of the supreme good as consisting in the possession or in the exercise of virtue, in a state of mind or in an activity. For it is possible for the state to be present in a person without affecting any good result, e.g. if he is asleep or quiescent in some other way, but not for the activity. He will necessarily act and act well. Just as at the Olympic Games, it is not the best looking or the strongest men present that are crowned with wreaths, but the competitors, because it is from them that the winners come. So it is those who act that rightly win the honors and rewards in life. End quote. Now, the Olympic Games started in Olympia, not too far outside of Athens, in 776 BC. What did you have to do to win? You had to compete. You couldn't just show up and strut around, and so it is with virtue. You can't just know these ideas, you have to live them. Theory, again, is rudimentary philosophy. Practice is the advanced work. I'm reminded of Donald Roberts' The Philosophy of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy, in which he tells us, quote, the ancients conceived of the ideal philosopher as a veritable warrior of the mind, a spiritual hero, akin to Hercules himself. But since the demise of the Hellenistic schools, the philosopher has become something more bookish, not a warrior, but a mere librarian of the mind, end quote. Here's to leaving the library and heading into the Olympic arena that is our lives. Next big idea, the doctrine of the mean. Quote, a cardinal rule, right conduct is incompatible with excess or deficiency. Aristotle tells us, first then, we must consider this fact, that it is in the nature of moral qualities that they are destroyed by deficiency and excess. Just as we can see, since we have to use the evidence of visible facts to throw light on those that are invisible, in the case of health and strength. For both excessive and insufficient exercise destroy one's strength, and both eating and drinking too much or too little destroy health, whereas the right quantity produces, increases, and preserves it. So it is the same with temperance, courage, and the other virtues. The man who shuns and fears everything and stands up to nothing becomes a coward. The man who is afraid of nothing at all but marches up to every danger becomes foolhardy. Similarly, the man who indulges in every pleasure and refrains from none becomes licentious. But if a man behaves like a boor and turns his back on every pleasure, he is a case of insensibility. Thus, temperance and courage are destroyed by excess and deficiency and preserved by the mean, end quote. Have you ever heard of the doctrine of the mean? Well, this book and that passage in particular is the source of it. In fact, walking us through the idea that virtuous activity of the soul is achieved by aiming at the mean between a vice of deficiency and a vice of excess is the essence of how to live with virtue. Aristotle walks us through a range of virtues to demonstrate this doctrine of the mean and help us achieve arete. The number one virtue we look at, courage, and then temperance or self-control, and those are what he calls moral virtues. Then we have intellectual virtues, like wisdom and prudence. In the realm of fear and confidence, if we have too much courage, we're no longer virtuous, we're rash. Too little courage, on the other hand, and of course, we're cowards. In the realm of pleasure and pain, too little self-control and we're licentious. Too much, we're bores. While in the realm of anger, for example, our virtuous mean is patience. Too little, and we're irascible. Too much patience, and we have a lack of spirit. And know this from Aristotle. He tells us, quote, for this reason, anyone who is aiming at the mean should, one, keep away from that extreme which is more contrary to the mean. Just as Calypso advises, far from this surf and surge keep thou ship. For one of the extremes is always more erroneous than the other. And since it is extremely difficult to hit the mean, we must take the next best course, as they say, and choose the lesser of the evils. And this will be most readily done in the way that we are suggesting. Number two, we must notice the errors into which we ourselves are liable to fall, because we all have different natural tendencies, and we must drag ourselves in the other direction. For we shall arrive at the mean by pressing well away from our failing, just like somebody straightening out a piece of wood, end quote. So, quick question. What direction do you tend to fall when you miss the mark? Shall we drag ourselves in the other direction? Yeah? How? Have that in mind the next time you do something that needs some work. And little PS here, the next time you miss the mark on virtue, recall that the opposite of being virtuous is technically being vicious. Then just say, needs work, and remember, quote, moral virtues, like crafts, are acquired by practice and habituation, end quote. All of which leads us to our next and final big idea, the greatness of your soul. Quote, greatness of soul, as the very name suggests, is concerned with things that are great. And we must first grasp of what sort these are. It makes no difference whether we consider the disposition or the person who corresponds to it. Well, a person is considered to be magnanimous if he thinks that he is worthy of great things, provided he is worthy of them. Because anyone who esteems his own worth unduly is foolish, and nobody who acts virtuously is foolish or stupid. The magnanimous man, then, is as we have described him. The man who is worthy of little consideration and thinks that he is such is temperate, but not magnanimous, because magnanimity implies greatness. just as beauty implies a well-developed body. The man who thinks that he is worthy of great things, although he is not worthy of them, is conceited. But not everybody is conceited who has too high an opinion of his own worth. On the other hand, the man who has too low an opinion is pusillanimous. And it makes no difference whether his worth is great or moderate or little if his opinion of it is too low. Indeed, the man whose worth is great might be regarded as especially pusillanimous, because what would his behavior be if his worth were not so great? So although the magnanimous man is an extreme as regards the greatness of his claims, as regards its rectitude, he is a mean, because he estimates himself at his true worth. The others show excess and deficiency. End quote. That is from Book 4, Other Moral Virtues, in which we explore other virtues like magnificence, which literally means being great and generous with the use of money, and friendliness. But what I want to focus on is this whole greatness of soul business. This passage is the one that jumped out at me the most. I was most struck by the concept of being pusillanimous, where you actually are capable of great things, but you don't properly see it. To bring the point home, how about a quick etymology lesson? First, we have magnanimity. That beautiful Greek word is made up of two other Greek words, magnus, or great, and animus, soul. The opposite of magnanimity? Pusillanimity. Just saying that word, tongue twister, in my head makes me wince. Now that comes from two Greek words as well, pusillus, for very small, plus animus, soul. These days, we define pusillanimity, as showing a lack of courage or determination, timid. Magnanimous, pusillanimous. In this context, Aristotle tells us that to be magnanimous is to properly see your great worth, your ability to do great things worthy of tremendous honor and praise. Aristotle describes this as the best person of all. They see their potential properly, and they act in accordance with that. Of course, if we think we're capable of doing great things, we're actually not capable of doing them and or not willing to do the things necessary to achieve them, we're conceited. That's the vice of excess. Falling into that zone is clearly not without risk, but for the moment, let's assume that we're properly grounded in striving to live with humility while dedicating our lives to serving something bigger than ourselves, etc. Then, we need to open our eyes to the possibility that we're missing the mark on the other side of the mean, that we're not seeing our true greatness, and we're being too timid in pursuit of those great things. Magnanimous, pusillanimous, a great soul or a very small soul? Which would you like to be? As we ponder that question, Eric Butterworth comes to mind and discover the power within you. He tells us, quote, "You may say, but I am only human." This is the understatement of your life. You are not only human, you are also divine in potential. The fulfillment of all your goals and aspirations in life depends upon stirring up and releasing more of that divine potential. And there is really nothing difficult about letting this inner light shine. All we must do is correct the tendency to turn off our light when we face darkness. End quote. Gandhi also comes to mind. You know what they called him? Mahatma. You know what Mahatma means? Great soul. It's from Sanskrit maha for great and atman, soul. Sound familiar? Now that's the kind of great soul we're talking about. I hereby challenge you, my dear friend, to step into the greatness of your soul. Here's to your magnanimity. Let's optimize our lives, actualize our potential, and change the world together. With eudaimonia and arete. That is an exceptionally quick look at the Nicomachean Ethics. I hope you enjoyed. If you did, I think you'll enjoy some of our other old school classics linked from the note. For now, let's enjoy some great quotes and then we'll wrap it up. Aristotle tells us, moral virtues like crafts are acquired by practice and habituation. He tells us, what is the good for man? It must be the ultimate end or object of human life. Something that is in itself completely satisfying. Happiness fits this description. Again, happiness in quotes, eudaimonic happiness. But what is happiness? If we consider what the function of man is, we find that happiness is a virtuous activity of the soul. By common consent, the beginning is more than half the whole task and throws a flood of light on many of the aspects of the inquiry. This much then is clear. In all our conduct, it is the mean that is to be commended, but one should incline sometimes toward excess and sometimes toward deficiency, because in this way we shall most easily hit upon the mean, that is, the right course. So too, it is easy to get angry. Anyone can do that, or to give and spend money. But to feel or act toward the right person, to the right extent, at the right time, for the right reason, in the right way, that is not easy. And it is not everyone that can do it. Hence, to do these things well is a rare, laudable, and fine achievement. Rash people are impetuous, eager before danger arrives, but shifty when it is actually present, whereas courageous ones are keen at the time of action, but calm beforehand. And finally, those states that are praiseworthy, we call virtues. In a word, arete, to achieve, eudaimonia. Here's a high five from my inner good soul to your inner good soul. Hope you enjoyed. What was the big idea that jumped out and landed? Go make it a habit. We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. Make today another awesome day. See ya. Little PS here. This is the 500th Philosopher's Note I've done, and I did it with a great smile on my face and a heart full of appreciation for your support in making it possible for me to do what I do. I feel blessed to be a part of your life, and I'm sending tons of love. Let's do this. The fun has just begun.
We hope you enjoyed this philosopher's note. Please go to optimize.me to download more.